I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe internationally exhibited artist Victor Ekpuk. He is an artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And Michelle. Katie Avery is here. She is residency director at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And we are talking today in particular because tonight is the open studios at the Art Institute at 5:30.
That is right. We have, in addition to Victor, six other artists and writers in residence. Each of them will take a short time to talk about their work and their process. The event is free. It's at 5:30 tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is at 1600 St. Michael's Drive on the Santa Fe University of Art and Design campus.
Right. Way down at the end when you go
way
in the driveway.
Down at the end.
Excellent. And always amazing artists. I was there yesterday and just looking at the different studios that you have set up there with artists from all over the place doing incredible work. And Victor is here today. Now, you are from Nigeria and do work, a lot of painting and drawing that incorporates kind of symbols and a visual symbolic language from Nigeria.
My work is just inspired by that old form of communication that also uses graphic symbols that represent concepts. But my approach to it was, you know, that art form becomes a platform for which mine comes out of, where I sort of inspired by that aesthetic philosophy of reducing forms or ideas to their essence. Basically, what I'm doing with my work now is to look for ways in which that, you know, that aesthetic philosophy, I could apply them to my contemporary work. And for the past years, I have been experimenting with that. I've been researching that and just exploring it so much that I have sort of formed my own style as it is today based on that aesthetic philosophy.
When you talk about reducing forms down to their essence, is that what you would call abstraction?
Yes, that would be abstraction, yeah. That would be what we call abstraction. And for me, it was sort of an eye-opener because, you know, when I was in college, the art curriculum was, you know, the idea was that, oh, yeah, abstraction is mainly things that, ideas that the 20th century Euro-American artists started.
But yeah, right.
But in investigating this, you know, this art form, especially the art forms from Nigeria, and I've come to read more about other cultures, other older cultures, I've realized that abstraction, they've always existed. They've existed not only as two-dimensional work, they've been expressed by painting, people painting them on their bodies, painting them or scratching forms and rock art, you know, on rocks. And users are applying all kinds of drawings and so on, and even on utensils and so on. So it really expands the scope of what it is that people have been doing long before. These forms also started to inspire artists of the 20th century who made it into a much larger, popularize it, and then started to claim it as their own.
Well, one of the things that you have done, which I find so interesting, is give a lecture with the whole slideshow and everything about some of the ways in which African art has influenced modern art, especially early 20th century art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I usually start from that point because so as long as I've been showing my work here in the West, the first reference have always been, oh, is that Miro, or is that Picasso, or is that Keith Haring, and so on. But that's okay because that is a point of reference for which the people who are asking those questions have. They may probably don't have any other point of reference. So when I talk about my work, as much as I don't like to, you know, get into anthropology, I find out that it's easier, or that I am at that position where I need to explain my work or explain myself or the philosophy behind what I do. And so I have to start from the beginning.
What do you mean by anthropology?
Well, because I usually sometimes bring in photos of the older art forms that inspire my work. And then that gets into anthropology because I start to talk about, I could bring a picture of body paintings, for instance, from Nigeria or from anywhere elsewhere in Africa, and I begin to show people, see, Don't look at the form. Look at the paintings on the body. That's where I get my ideas for my own abstractions from. Or it could be a cloth that has patterns on them that are very traditional to my culture or to any other African culture. And I also, well, actually, if you really look at it, then you could see elements of that in my work, and that's where I come from. And it might even, if you wanted to look at those patterns and begin to compare them with works of Semiro, for instance, or Modigliani, then you begin to see how those ideas came about in their work as well. So they're not the starting point of any new or any ideas that are coming out now. They also were inspired by something else. But for some reason, that is not usually emphasized, either in the academic canons or so.
Well, I mean, it's sort of a classic example of what you might call Eurocentric ways of seeing. You think that either these guys invented those forms or ways of seeing, mm-hmm. or even if they took them from some other influence, they made it much greater than it was before.
Right. Yeah, I mean, as artists, I believe that we are always being influenced by something, by our environment, by whatever it is in the world that influences our aesthetics. So we all should feel free to tap from it. But I guess part of the issue I have is when artists do not acknowledge those influences.
Well, we were talking the other day, and you were telling me about a huge art show that was, I think, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York called Inventing Abstraction.
Right, yeah. I haven't seen this show, but I was really intrigued by the response to it by a critic. The article is in Huffington Post. It's called Colonizing Abstraction. Right. And he did a very good job of putting side by side the arts of the 20th century artists that are shown at MoMA and similar works from other cultures, other non-Western cultures that may have inspired that. Basically, his argument was that by the curators at MoMA calling it inventing abstraction, they've totally neglected the fact that abstraction have existed long before the 20th century artists. Now, the fact, abstraction has existed in other people's cultures, and most of it has also inspired the works by the 20th century artists. And I thought that was very illuminating because, point by point, he's put side by side all of these illustrations to prove the point.
We're talking to Victor Ekpuk, who is an artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. I think it's also important to really think about, and for those of us who don't have very much familiarity with African art as we might with European art, that not only was abstract art around for centuries, if not millennia, in all kinds of other non-Western cultures, but it was every bit as profound and meaningful and culturally rich as we might feel that it is here. And I was thinking of that specifically while looking at some of the patterns on those Nigerian indigo cloths that are very, very beautiful. And we look at them at Folk Art Market and say, oh, how beautiful. But in fact, for somebody else, they are a profound expression of all sorts of things, which I don't have the eyes to see.
Yeah, the indigo cloth you're referring to, it's called Ukara cloth. It's made for members of the Ekpe Society. Ekpe Society is a leopard, it's a sacred male society in Nigeria that employs codes of communication that sometimes they use speech, sometimes they use placement of objects, and then they also use graphic symbols. It is one of the major inspiration for my work. Is my work, I sort of focused on the graphic aspect of the work is what I take from. And those patterns that one sees on those clothes, they all have meanings. They're codes. Some people call them writings that represent concepts. And I also see that in some Native American arts themselves and how they were to bring out or to draw those beautiful abstract patterns that some other people might actually think that they're writing or so on. And I see those in those works, and which is, it brought me to begin to think that the parallel between, Native American mark making and African art of mark making. Actually, one of the things I wanted to do here was also to come in and investigate that in Santa Fe and try to see that with those relationships.
So there are some, for example, petroglyphs and Native American Southwestern art in particular that reminds you of home.
Yeah, they really do. I mean, not even that, and just sometimes driving up the freeway and some of the landscapes themselves actually do remind me a little bit of some of the semi-arid areas in Nigeria. But when I do look at those works, I can see it's very profound, actually, how they're able to just sort of distill their lives and their ideas of what their universe was into simple, basic lines. And sometimes I believe some of those were actually also coded symbols for ritual purposes that were, and I see that similarity too with the NCBD art of writing.
NCBD art of writing being a Nigerian form
right.
of communication.
Right, being a Nigerian form of communication by this Leopard Society, and which is also, actually, we were talking about it the other day, it's also called Abakwa in Cuba.
Right.
Because the Africans who were taken as slaves to Cuba maintain that religion up till today, and they call it Abakwa, and they still sing those songs and have those masquerades and so on.
And in their rituals and music is your language.
Yes. Yeah, within the music, sometimes a scholar brought some Cuban Abakwa members to perform in Nigeria, but in Washington D.C. And I could hear some of the language, some of the local languages that I understand. You know, it's sort of a mixture of Cuban Spanish and Efik or Ibibio language, which I come from. I thought that was really profound.
It is. I mean, this is yet another diaspora in the world, Nigerian, or I don't know if you can call it Nigerian. It's hard to talk about places that are countries now but weren't countries when the people left.
Right, so there were Ibibios, there were Igbos and Efiks and Ejagam people in the Cross River area in southeast Nigeria. That's mainly where they, that's where they came from. Or where they took off from to go to Cuba.
To Cuba and probably also to Brazil and all kinds of other places where that culture survives. Have you investigated that and talked to artists who are working it with that kind of visual language in the Americas?
I have seen those works before, and I've spoken with just a few artists. I would like to do more. There's some really well-known artists like Jose Badia from Cuba, who uses a lot of sign languages as well. He's a contemporary artist too. I'm always interested in artists who do that. And part of also what I would like to do before I leave this residency is also to meet Native American artists who are really invested in the use of their own symbols from their heritage to create contemporary work. I want to be able to see if we could have a point of discussion on what it is that inspires you with the ancient art forms, just as it inspires me. I could just be any other person who is interested in, who has invested in using the ancient art forms, whether they are Native Americans or not. There has to be something within it that moves those artists to want to use the symbols to create.
So if there are any artists out there who would like to talk about these issues further and meet Victor, they can go to the Santa Fe Art Institute tonight at 5:30 for the open studios, and also can come by, I guess, anytime in the next, 5 or 6 weeks, you'll still be here.
Right.
And the number over there is 424-5050 if people want to just call. And I mean, I guess they can just, you're in the studio all the time, so they can just come by and
they can call the institute and find out if I'm there, and so we could have. I'm really look forward to meeting artists of like minds, and I also want to somebody who has a knowledge of Native American art forms, whether they be the writings or poetry. I'd love to have that discussion.
I wanted to ask you about something that has been kind of bothering me for a while when people are making distinctions between traditional art and contemporary art. And it seems that perhaps in my lifetime, the world has come together in such a way that those distinctions between traditional folk art and contemporary art aren't there the way they used to be. I mean, you don't really have maybe some remote villagers somewhere are doing the traditional forms the way they've done them, but it seems like everybody is influenced by this whole global culture. I wanted to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, everybody is influenced by the global culture, and more so, people are influenced by commerce as well. So you have to look at that aspect. So sometimes what you call traditional. So at what point is it traditional? At what year is it traditional? Is it the style? Or does the contemporary life affect the style, and so on. So it, the term I like to use is, you know, traditional contemporary, because people are still making them. There are people out there who, for the reason of commerce, have chosen to continue to make this art form because the market demands that style, which they call quote unquote traditional.
We see that everywhere in New Mexico, for
right.
example.
And even though these people are living and they are contemporary, the market has driven and has ascribed that name to that particular. And there's some artists who have also incorporated a lot of, like I went to a talk at the Museum of Museum Hill.
Museum of American Indian Art and
yeah,
Culture.
Right. And there are these artists who are, even though they're still practicing the traditional form of pottery, they have incorporated contemporary ideas. So in that case, they kind of mock, you know, muddies the water. Are they contemporary artists or are they traditional artists? You know, what is it?
and why do we need to define it anyway?
Well, like I said, it's also about, I think it's commerce. And apart from that, it's also, some scholars have invested in writing their essays about what is traditional and so on. And that's what people have been told. And people just, it begins to be what everybody hears. And and that's how it continues to be. Because I believe that cultures are always evolving. So trying to make one stay in one place for a long time is just not attainable, I think. And, you know, artists are, just for the point of maybe they want to get into a certain museum, they'll say, well, I'm not traditional anymore, I'm contemporary, or I bring contemporary, even bring traditional, I'm inspired by traditional, but I am creating contemporary. So it gets a little, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little odd. I was wondering, what's the scene, the art scene like in Nigeria? I mean, you've been living in the United States for quite mm-hmm. a while, but there are artists like you who are working in painting and sculpture and all kinds of things who are inspired by traditional culture but are doing, what is it, contemporary art for the market or for museums or...
Right. Well, so that's the thing. I mean, the Nigerian art market is quite vibrant right now. And there are diverse artists who paint, who use, it could be the impressionist style to really abstract. And they can, they're free to choose wherever the inspiration comes from. You know, there are others like me who are interested in the forms of what my forefathers used to do and try to bring them into contemporary expressions. There are other artists who are still, especially... still also creating work in the traditional forms that have been there for quite a while, and they are selling them. There is a market for those for kind of forms as well.
A tourist market?
Tourist market, and people who just want to buy quote-unquote traditional style work. But even that, it changes. And so, I mean, there's this issue about artists, especially artists of like me, who are from non-Euro-American tradition, who have been trying to fight the stigma of being put in one box as African artists. Maybe Native American artists, I don't know. I've not discussed with a Native American artist, so I don't know what their attitude is that by being put in that box. And they can only show in certain spaces because they've been tagged that name. I guess for what artists like me are trying to say that we are contemporary artists. And there's something is important in our study that we need to bring out. And being put in a box of Africa or Nigerian or Native American or that sort of thing instead of totally limits involvement.
Yeah, and makes false distinctions about
right.
what people are doing, because all kinds of people are working with similar materials, similar visual languages,
right.
traveling to the same places and so on.
Yeah, especially in these days of the internet. You don't even need to go to Africa to be influenced by African artists out there. You just click in something and the image comes to you.
Exactly.
So do you now call a Chinese artist who has seen an African form and decides to include it in his work an African artist then? Or is he making African art? Or it's always interesting to me that Picasso was never, his work was never classified as African art, even though African art was what really gave a jump to, you know, in his career when he started, you know, investigating African art. So it becomes a very murky issue. I think people should just be artists, period, and just move on.
So when you were in art school and university in Nigeria, what was the teaching like? Were you exposed to every kind of medium and method? Was it more the sort of Euro-American forms like painting and sculpture and so on?
Yeah, I was exposed to all kinds of medium. Don't forget that Nigeria was an old British colony. So part of that curriculum also came along, and we studied figurative work, the modernist work and impressionist style of painting, and we used oil colors and acrylics and, you know, stuff like that to express ourselves. But what changed was that we also had a specific instruction to look into the culture which we come from and use that to see what we can come out of to express ourselves contemporarily. So we learned all of that, and some people continue in that tradition and some people decided to go a different direction.
So people can go to the Santa Fe Art Institute tonight at 5:30 and see your work and see the work of many other artists who are there. Katie,
yes.
Tell us about some of the other folks.
A lot of painters. There are a lot of painters right now. We have Emily Adams, who is a painter, Sal Strom, who's a video maker, Klaus Hugh from Berlin, who is a painter and curator, Cassandra Lopez, who is a poet and writer, Thomas Cummins, who's a photographer, and Andrea Jokey, also a painter.
And so visitors can walk around and see the work, and also each artist will give a presentation for 10 minutes, something like that?
A short presentation for about 5 minutes, and then everyone is welcome to wander through the studios and talk to the artists in their studios after that point.
And there's refreshments.
And there are refreshments.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Katie Avery is residency director at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and Victor Ekpuk is artist in residence there. And I will connect also, Victor, to your own website on santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe composer Daniel Stephen Crafts. He will be in Santa Fe this coming weekend. It's part of Canticum Novum's spring offering, which is the ninth season concerts. And this Saturday and Sunday here in Santa Fe at the Cristo Rey Church, there will be a performance of a lot of pieces, including your piece, Daniel La Llorona. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you. Now, this is, of course, excerpts from La Llorona, because La Llorona is an opera in three acts, so they're not going to perform the whole thing. But you wrote this with Rudolfo Anaya writing the libretto. How did you come to do this project?
Well, actually, as it turns out, I had approached him on another subject. I was writing a vocal piece, an extended vocal piece, for the great tenor Jerry Hadley, who had spent a summer here and fell in love with the landscape of enchantment, of course, and suggested that we do a piece all about the American Southwest. And one of the writers that I knew from which I wanted to get a text was Rudolfo Anaya. So we met, and I told him something about myself, and he said, "Oh, you write operas." He said, "Well, you know, I have a play that I bet would make a great opera." And I said, "Well, by all means, please let me see it." Then he said, "Okay, I'll send it to you in the mail." So I got an envelope in the mail a couple days later, and I opened it up, and it said, "Time and place, Halloween night." I thought, "Oh, this is perfect. This is wonderful." Well, what it turned out to be was his play, The Season of La Llorona. And he takes the Hispanic legend of La Llorona, of which there are many, many, many versions, but he took his version of it and married it to the history of the conquest of the Aztecs by Captain Cortez and the woman Malinche, who was his translator and later his consort. And there's even a third tier to it, because the play and the opera opens in contemporary Albuquerque on Halloween night.
Nice.
And the little boy, Alfredo, is dressed in his Halloween costume, monster costume. Mama is baking bizcochitos in the kitchen, and suddenly there's a knock at the door. Trick-or-treaters, says little Alfredo, and he runs to the door, but it's Abuelo, grandfather. Well, grandfather comes in, and he admires the little boy's costume, and he has a bizcochito, and then he says to Alfredo, well, you know, Halloween is a lot of fun for Americanos, but let me tell you a really gory story. Let me tell you about La Llorona. Who's La Llorona, Grandpa? Who's La Llorona? He says, what? I never told you the story of Malinche, the beautiful Aztec princess who betrayed and was betrayed? And then at this point, Abuelo, who is really Rodolfo Anaya, the storyteller, sings a little arioso that introduces the scene. And then magically, all of a sudden, we're transported back to the time of the Aztecs. And we're inside a beautiful Aztec temple with all of those wonderful designs and things like that on the wall. And then we meet Malinche and Captain Cortez. And it's now this is about 10 years after the conquest of the Aztecs, and they've had a child together. And he's so about 8 years old, something like that. Well, the captain has been away for some time, and he comes back, and he sees the little boy all dressed as an Aztec and brandishing a spear, and he's disgusted with this. He says, no more. I'm not bringing my son up to be a savage. He said, I'm going to take him with me back to Spain and teach him how to be a proper Spanish nobleman. Well, now Malinche is feeling great guilt because she's betrayed her people once already. And the idea of her son being trained to be further oppressive of her people is just more than she can bear. And that's kind of where we begin the excerpts that we're doing on Saturday and Sunday.
And for those of you who are from New Mexico, you can guess the rest of the story. So this is great. So you got, this is amazing. So you got this text in the mail, read it, said, oh my goodness, this is an incredible thing to make an opera out of.
Well, the character of La Llorona has, as I said, there are many, many versions of the legend, and it has been set to popular music many, many times. But I am so proud to say I got the first shot at creating this as an operatic character. And she's such an archetypal figure. I mean, in a way, it's much like Medea in killing her children.
Exactly. It's the same story in a lot of ways.
In many ways, it is. In many ways, it is. But it's just the thing that opera cuts its teeth on. It's you know, all this incredible emotion, because Malinche feels that she ultimately kills the child, and you probably think, you know, a mother killing her child is probably the most heinous thing you can think of. But as the story unfolds, you realize that this poor woman is backed into a corner. And she's so conflicted by the whole situation that she feels there's really no way out. And the scene, one of the scenes that we do, the big aria for Malinche, is she goes into the temple and she summons the spirit of Moctezuma, the dead Aztec king, Moctezuma. And Moctezuma appears to her and he hands her an obsidian knife. And she thinks, oh, I'm to take my life. Well, I understand that. I understand that. That's all right. But then the little boy enters the temple and the ghost points to the little boy. And she says, oh my God, he wants me, the God wants me to kill my son. And it's a moment of incredible tension.
It was like Abraham and Isaac in the Bible.
Yes, very good. That's another good parallel.
Yeah. We're talking to composer Daniel Stephen Crafts. So, La Llorona, so you wrote the opera. Has it been performed as a whole yet?
Never as a whole. We've done excerpts of it several times in San Francisco. We did staged excerpts of it at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in 2008. And that was with a piano reduction, a piano and several instruments. This is the first time it's actually been done, any of it has been done with orchestra. So I'm very pleased with that. And Kenneth Knight, who directs Canticum Novum, is a wonderful, wonderful conductor. And I feel very, very secure in his hands.
Yeah, so you've got some terrific singers who are performing this piece.
The singers are absolutely wonderful. Well, Deborah Domansky just returned from a stint at the Metropolitan Opera. I mean, that's how good she is. I fell in love with her voice a number of years ago when she appeared in a starring role in the Santa Fe Opera's production of Radamisto. She sang the character Zenobia. And I was just entranced with her voice. It just blew me away. And then turns out she lives in Santa Fe. And she lives just around the corner from a friend of mine. And we've since become very good friends in the last couple of years. But she is my absolute choice to sing the role of Malinche. And I'm delighted that we have this first opportunity. I hope first of many.
One thing I admire about your work, and we talked with you last year about your production of the opera, or the first act of the opera that you wrote called Too Much Coffee Man, which was inspired by the comic book by the same name. But one thing I really admire is that you are working outside of academia, working outside of the sort of normal bureaucratic places, not that there's anything wrong with them necessarily, but where composers have the freedom to work. And from my perspective, it seems like that gives you the freedom to take on subjects that aren't normally taken on by contemporary composers.
Well, in a way, that's the whole idea of gonzo opera.
Define that.
Well, gonzo is definitely not what you're going to hear this weekend. This is an opera in the traditional sense. It's very dark. It's very, very emotional. But what I've been working in recently is what I've been come to call gonzo opera, which is real opera. It's not a parody or satire. I mean, using beautiful, beautiful operatic voices, but putting them in wild and crazy satirical comic situations that you would never expect to find in opera, such as Too Much Coffee Man. And the main character comes in dressed in that outrageous suit and then begins to sing all about life, love, the universe, whatever. But
and the barista.
The barista is a wonderful character who knows there's more than just working as a coffee girl. That there's a whole world out there and she's dying to explore it.
And you're writing another one now about the whole world of cell phones and devices and people not really talking to each other.
Yes, it's called Cellular World. And the libretto is by my dear friend Janice Lieber, who's a wonderful political satirist. She has a website called Chopped Liver. And by all means, go to it. It's always very, very funny. And this the Cellular World, which I just finished writing just last week, it opens up. On stage, you have two couples in bed on opposite sides of the stage with their backs to each other, and they're all texting somebody else about how lonely and miserable they are.
Exactly. There we have it. Well, and this is the thing. It's like if we watch a Mozart opera, we might get some themes which are still relevant today, but it's still out of another time, and these are the issues of our time, which they weren't writing about in the 19th century or the 18th.
You know, that's the thing I was just talking to somebody, that comedy really, the jokes go out of style so quickly. I mean, like in Shakespeare, there are wonderful, wonderful jokes, but they virtually all have to be explained to somebody. And
it's
how funny
true.
Can they be after they're, you know, after they have to be explained?
Well, I saw a compilation of the entire history of New Yorker cartoons. And so I went back to the beginning, and I didn't understand half of them.
Yeah.
Because they were relevant to some political situation or style thing of that time.
Topical reference
that
we don't really even know about, unless you're an expert in that particular period.
But then again, the wonderful thing about whether it be opera or theater is that some of the themes and even some of the humor does carry over the ages.
Indeed, indeed.
And I would think the theme of alienation and technology isn't going away anytime soon.
Not anytime soon, that's for sure. It may transfigure itself into some other sorts of devices or inventions. Undoubtedly, it will. But no, I think that concept of alienation is here with it.
You also have the distinction of writing melodies and music that is accessible to regular people who aren't necessarily into, let's say, 12-tone music or I mean, again, for the people who love that stuff, it's fantastic and it's all good. I'm not putting it down, but it's a lot of people, the reason they're listening to 18th and 19th century classical music is because it does seem to be more accessible.
It's melody. You know, the thing is, you can look at the whole history of what's called classical music from Gregorian chant up to, well, the middle of the 20th century anyway, and almost without exception, the classics are classics because they have great melodies, great memorable melodies. That's the thing.
Melodies and harmonies.
That's why people remember them. And so without that, you're losing one of the key elements of what makes music work.
Now, you have a great story about how when you were young, you got a wonderful offer to study at a music conservatory, but it didn't work out precisely because you wanted to write melody.
That's true. Well, at the time, and I give myself away at this point, in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was attempting to study composition officially, all anybody wanted to teach at that time was 12-tone theory or its many garden varieties or just the perpetually dissonant styles of music, which to me were not only aesthetically repugnant, but politically and philosophically reactionary, quite frankly. And I knew that was never going to work. But try to tell people that when, you know.
When so what did what happened?
Well, I just went off on my own. I say to people, when they ask me, who did you study with? I say, well, I studied with Mozart, Wagner, and Prokofiev. And they had a world of things to tell me just by looking at the scores, looking at all sorts of music, really, but studying the scores and seeing how and why music works.
Now, in your life, you've had a number of very fruitful collaborations, and we just talked about La Llorona and the collaboration with Rudolfo Anaya. You also worked very extensively with a wonderful tenor named Jerry Hadley, who unfortunately passed away several years ago.
He took his own life in a fit of horrible depression, which he suffered from. Well, I met Jerry in San Francisco, where I'm from, and actually, we got on really well because he was even more adamant against these dissonant styles of music than I was. And I didn't think that was possible. But he had lots of derogatory adjectives for that kind of music, which I won't even go into on the air. But anyway, we got on really, really well because he asked me to send him some of my music, and he called me back a few weeks later, and he said, "My God, you really do write melody." He said, "A lot of people say they do, but you really do write melody, and I would very much like you to write for me." And so that
was the beginning, and you recorded quite a lot with him.
Well, we recorded some. Unfortunately, when he passed away, we had a number of projects on the drawing board that never came to fruition. Actually, one of them is this, the tenor role in La Llorona of the Captain Cortez. And that was written for Jerry Hadley, but he never got the opportunity to sing it. Mm. So the tenor who's singing it here is a wonderful, wonderful young tenor by the name of Javier Gonzalez. And I first heard him with the New Mexico Philharmonic last year and thought he had a wonderful voice. And so I was delighted to recruit him to sing the role of Cortez. And him being Hispanic, of course, he loved the idea of playing Hernando Cortez.
Right, right. So Daniel Stephen Kraft is a composer, and excerpts from his opera La Llorona will be performed this weekend. It's part of Canticum Novum's spring concert of this year. And it's Saturday at 7 o'clock and then Sunday at 3 o'clock at Cristo Rey Church, which is on Canyon Road right here in Santa Fe. The wonderful Ken Knight is the artistic director and conductor. For more information, people can go to sfcanticumnovum.com. Now, we've got a little bit of time left. Would you like to play some music? Do you have anything from La Llorona, or should we hear something else?
Well, we don't have any really good recordings of La Llorona. That's one thing that I will get from this concert, is a really good recording with these wonderful singers and this wonderful orchestra and Kenneth Knight. There are some things. The recording, the one project that we did finish with Jerry Hadley was an extended vocal work called The Song and the Slogan, which is settings of poems by Carl Sandburg. And Sandburg was a very interesting character. He was a great advocate of working people's rights, and he would go around the country making political speeches. But to make the message go down a little easier, he would pepper his speeches with folk songs, singing folk songs. And that is the tradition out of which comes people like Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Burl Ives, even Bob Dylan later on. It all comes from Carl Sandburg.
Wow.
So when Jerry proposed to me that we set something of Carl Sandburg, I said, absolutely, I would be delighted to do that. And the result was this piece called The Song and the Slogan, which is taken from a line from one of the poems that we used.
So we will hear a little bit of that right now before we go. Daniel Stephen Crafts, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Ray Charlotte.
Sky moon on fire, double. After the sunburn of the day, handling a pitchfork at a hay rack, after the eggs and biscuit and coffee, the pearl gray haystacks in the gloaming are cool. Time.